Baroque tried to follow the half-orc's movements, but both his arms were pulled outright, shackled tight at the wrists. One hand was in a press, the other in a framework box of strange design, its panels holding the hand open, fingers extended so that the jailer could play with them one at a time. The prelate shrugged, held his hands up, and when Morrick didn't immediately reply, a cat-and-nine-tails switched across the rogue's naked back, leaving deep lines that hurt all the more for the sweat. "You had the poison," Volton logically asserted, "and the insidious weapons. But it was not the same poison in the vial we recovered. A clever ruse, I suspect, to throw us off the correct path in trying to heal Captain Dutermont's wounds."
"A ruse indeed," Morrick said dryly.
The jailer hit him again with a whip and raised his arm for a third strike. However, Volton raised his arm to hold the brutal thug at bay.
"You admit it?" Volton asked.
"All of it," Morrick replied. "A ruse perpetrated by someone else, delivering to me and Wolfgar what you consider the evidence against us, then striking out at Dudemont when he came over to speak. Enough!"
said an obviously frustrated Volton, for he and all of the other interrogators had heard the same nonsense over and over from both Morrick and Wolfgar. The prelate rose and turned to leave, shaking his head. Morrick knew what that meant.
"I can tell you other things,"
the rogue pleaded, but Volton just lifted his arm and waved his hand dismissively. Morrick started to speak out again, but he lost his words and his breath as the jailer slugged him hard in the kidney. Morrick yelped and jumped, which only made the pain in his hand and thumb all the more exquisite. Still, despite all self-control, he jumped again when the jailer struck him another blow, for the thug was wearing a metal strip across his knuckles, inlaid with several pins. Morrick thought of his drow visitors that night long ago in the small apartment he kept near the cutlass. Did they know what was happening? Would they come and rescue Wolfgar, and if they did, would they rescue Morrick as well? He had almost told Wolfgar about them in those first hours when they had been chained in the same room, hesitating only because he feared that Wolfgar, so obviously lost in agonizing memories, wouldn't even hear him, and that somebody else might. Wouldn't it be wonderful if the magistrates could pin on him as well a charge that he was an associate of dark elves? Not that it mattered. Another punch slammed in, then the jailer went for the whip again to cut a few new lines on his back. If those drow didn't come, his fate, Morrick knew, was sealed in a most painful way. Robillard had been only gone for a few moments, but when he returned to Dudermont's room, he found half a dozen priests working furiously on the captain. Camerbund stood back, directing the group.
"He is on fire inside," the priest explained.
And even from this distance, Robillard could see the truth of that statement from the color of the feverish Dudermont and the great streaks of sweat that trailed down his face. Robillard noticed, too, that the room was growing colder, and he realized that a pair of the six working on Dudermont were casting spells not to heal, but to create cold. "I have spells that will do the same," Robillard offered. "Powerful spells on scrolls back at Seasprite. Perhaps my captain would be better served if your priests were able to focus on healing."
"Run," Camerbund said, and Robillard did him one better, using a series of dimensional doors to get back to Seasprite in a matter of moments.
The wizard fished through his many components and scroll tubes, magical items and finely crafted pieces he meant to enchant when he found the time, at last coming upon a scroll with a trio of spells for creating ice, along with the necessary components. Cursing himself for not being better prepared, and vowing that he would devote all his magical energies the next day to memorizing such spells, Robillard gated back to the chamber in the chapel. The priests were still working frenetically, and the old herb woman was there as well, rubbing a creamy white salve all over Dudemont's wet chest. Robillard prepared the components, a vial of ice troll blood, a bit of fur from the great white bear, and unrolled the scroll, flattening it on a small table. He tore his gaze from the dying Dudemont, focusing on the task at hand.
And with the discipline only a wizard might know, he methodically went to work, chanting softly and waggling his fingers and hands. He poured the cold ice troll blood on his thumb and index finger, then clasped the fur between them and blew onto it, once, twice, thrice, then cast the fur to the floor along a bare wall at the side of the room. A tap-tapping began there, hail bouncing off the floor, louder as the chunks came larger and larger, until, within a matter of moments, Captain Dudermont was laid upon a new bed, a block of ice.
"This is the critical hour," Camerbon explained. "His fever is too great, and I fear he may die of it. Blood as thin as water pours from his orifices. I have more priests waiting to step in when this group has exhausted their healing spells, and I have sent several to other chapels, even of rival gods, begging aid."
Camerbon smiled at the wizard's surprised expression.
"They will come," he assured Robillard. "All of them."
Robillard was not a religious man, mainly because in his days of trying to find a god that fit his heart, he found himself distressed at the constant bickering and rivalries of the many varied churches. So he understood the compliment Camerbun had just paid to the captain. What a great reputation Dudermont had built among the honest folk of the northern Sword Coast, that all would put aside rivalries and animosity to join in for his sake. They did come, as Camerbun promised. Priests of nearly every persuasion in Luskin, flocking in six at a time to expend their healing energies over the battered captain. Dudermont's fever broke around midnight. He opened a weary eye to find Robillard asleep next to him. The wizard's head was cradled on his folded arms on the captain's small bed, next to Dudermont's side.
"How many days?"
the weak captain asked. For he recognized that something was very wrong here, very strange, as if he had just awakened from a long and terrible nightmare. Also, though he was wrapped in a sheet, he knew that he was on no normal bed, for it was too hard and his backside was wet. Robillard jumped up at the sound, eyes wide. He put his hand to Dudermont's forehead, and his smile widened considerably when he felt that the man was cool to the touch. "Camerbon," he called, drawing a curious look from the confused captain. It was the most beautiful sight Robillard had ever seen.
"Three circuits," came the nasally voice of
Jarkeld the magistrate, a thin old wretch who took far too much pleasure in his tasks for Morik's liking. Every day the man walked through the dungeon caverns, pointing out those whose time had come for prisoners' carnival, and declaring, based on the severity of their crime, or perhaps merely from his own mood, the preparation period for each. A circuit, according to the jailer who regularly beat Morik, was the time it took for a slow walk around the plaza where the prisoners' carnival was held. So the man Jarkeld had just labeled for three circuits would be brought up to carnival and tortured by various means for about half an hour before Jarkeld even began the public hearing. It was done to rouse the crowd, Morik understood, and the old wretch Jarkeld liked the hearty cheers.
"So you have come to beat me again,"
Morik said when the brutish jailer walked into the natural stone chamber where the rogue was chained to the wall.
"Have you brought the holy man with you? Or the magistrate, perhaps? Is he to join us to order me up to the carnival?"
"No beating today, Morik the rogue," the jailer said. "They're not wanting anything more from ye. Captain Dudermont's not needing ye any more."
"He died?"
Morik asked, and he couldn't mask a bit of concern in his tone. If Dudermont had died, the charge against Wulfgar and Morik would be heinous murder, and Morik had been around Luskin long enough to witness more than a few executions of people so charged, executions by torture that lasted the better part of a day at least.
"Nah,"
the jailer said with obvious sadness in his tone.
"Nah, we're not so lucky. Dudermont's living, and all the better. So it looks like yourself and Wulfgar'll get killed quick and easy."
"Oh, joy," said Morik.
The brute paused for a moment and looked around, then waded in close to Morik and hit him a series of wicked blows about the stomach and chest.
"I'm thinking that Magistrate Jarkeld'll be calling ye up to the carnival soon enough," the jailer explained. "Wantin' to get in a few pardons is all."
"My thanks," the ever-sarcastic rogue replied, and that got him a left hook across the jaw that knocked out a tooth and filled his mouth with warm blood. Durimont's strength was fast returning, so much so that the priest had a very difficult task in keeping the man in his bed. Still they prayed over him, offering spells of healing, and the old herbalist woman came in with pots of tea and another soothing salve.
"It could not have been Wulfgar," Durimont protested to Robillard, who had told him the entire story since the near tragedy in front of the cutlass.
"Wulfgar and Morik," Robillard said firmly. "I watched it, Captain, and a good thing for you that I was watching."
"It makes no sense to me," Durimont replied. "I know Wulfgar."
"Knew," Robillard corrected.
"But he is a friend of Drizzt and Catti Bree, and we both know that those two would have nothing to do with an assassin, nothing good at least."
"Was a friend," Robillard stubbornly corrected. "Now Wulfgar makes friends the likes of Morik the Rogue, a notorious street thug, and another pair, I believe, worse by far."
"Another pair?" Durimont asked. And even as he did, Waylon McCanty and another crewman from Sea Sprite entered the room. They went to the captain first, bowed and saluted, both smiling widely, for Durimont seemed even better than he had earlier in the day when all the crew had come running to Robillard's joyous call.
"Have you found them?" the wizard asked impatiently.
"I believe we have," a smug-looking Waylon replied. "Hiding in the hold of a boat just two berths down from Sea Sprite."
"They haven't come out much of late," the other crewman offered. "We talked to some men at the cutlass who thought they knew the pair and claimed that the one-eyed sailor was dropping gold coins without regard."
Robillard nodded knowingly. So it was a contracted attack, and those two were a part of the plan.
"With your permission, Captain," the wizard said, "I should like to take Sea Sprite out of dock."
Durimont looked at him curiously, for the captain had no idea what this talk might be about.
"I sent Mr. McCanty on a search for two other accomplices in the attack against you," Robillard explained. "It appears that we may have located them."
"But Mr. McCanty just said they were in port," Durimont reasoned.
"They're aboard Bow-Legged Lady as paying passengers. When I put Sea Sprite behind them, all weapons to bear, they will likely turn the pair over without a fight,"
Robillard reasoned, his eyes aglow. Now Durimont managed to chuckle.
"I only wish that I could go with you," he said.
The three took that as their cue and turned immediately for the door.
"What of Magistrate Jarkeld?" Durimont asked quickly before they could skitter away.
"I bade him to hold on the justice for the pair," Robillard replied, "as you requested. We shall need them to confirm that these newest two were in on the attack as well."
Durimont nodded and waved the trio away, falling into his own thoughts. He still didn't believe that Wulfgar could be involved, though he had no idea how he might prove it. In Luskan, as in most of the cities of Faerûn, even the appearance of criminal activity could get a man hanged, or drawn and quartered, or whatever unpleasant manner of death the presiding magistrate could think up.
"An honest traitor I be, and ye got no proof otherways,"
Captain Pinnickers of Bow-Legged Lady declared, leaning over the taffrail and calling out protests against the appearance of the imposing Sea Sprite, catapult, ballista, and ranks of archers trained on his decks.
"As I have already told you, Captain Pinnickers, we have come not for your ship, nor for you, but for a pair you harbor,"
Robillard answered with all due respect.
"Bah! Go away with ye, or I'll be calling out the city guard,"
the tough old sea dog declared.
"No difficult task,"
Robillard replied smugly, and he motioned to the wharves behind Bow-Legged Lady. Captain Pinnickers turned to see 100 city soldiers or more lining the dock, grim-faced and armed for battle.
You have nowhere to run or hide, Robillard explained. I ask your permission one more time as a courtesy to you. For your own sake, allow me and my crew to board your ship and find the pair we seek.
My ship,
Pinnaker said, poking a finger into his chest. Or I shall order my gunners to have at it, Robillard explained, standing tall and imposing at Sea Sprite's rail, all pretense of politeness flown. I shall join in with spells of destruction you cannot even begin to imagine. Then we will search the wreckage for the pair ourselves. Pinnaker seemed to shrink back just a bit, but he held fast his grim and determined visage. I offer you the choice one last time, Robillard said, his mock politeness returning.
Fine choice,
Pinnaker grumbled. He gave a helpless little wave, indicating that Robillard and the others should cross to his deck. They found Creeps Sharky and Tianicnik in short order, with Robillard easily identifying them. They also found an interesting item on a beam near the tattooed man-creature. A hollow tube.
Blowgun,
Waylon McCanty explained, presenting it to Robillard. Indeed, said the wizard, examining the exotic weapon and quickly confirming its use from the design. What might someone shoot from it?
Something small, with an end shaped to fill the tube, McCanty explained.
He took the weapon back, pursed his lips, and blew through the tube. It wouldn't work well if too much wind escaped around the dart.
Small, you say? Like a cat's claw? Robillard asked, eyeing the captured pair. With a pliable feathered end?
Following Robillard's gaze at the miserable prisoners, Waylon McCanty nodded grimly. Wulfgar was lost somewhere far beyond pain, hanging limply from his shackled wrists, both bloody and torn. The muscles on the back of his neck and shoulders had long ago knotted, and even if he had been released and dropped to the floor, only gravity would have changed his posture. The pain had pushed too far and too hard, and had released Wulfgar from his present prison. Unfortunately for the big man, that escape had only taken him to another prison, a darker place by far, with torments beyond anything these mortal men could inflict upon him. Tempting, naked, and wickedly beautiful succubi flew around him. The great pincer-armed Glabrezu came at him repeatedly, snapping, snapping, nipping pieces of his body away. All the while he heard the demonic laughter of Ertu the Conqueror. Ertu, the great Balor who hated Drizdo Urden above all other mortals and played out that anger continually upon Wulfgar.
Wulfgar?
The call came from far away. Not a throaty, demonic voice like Ertu's, but gentle and soft. Wulfgar knew the trap, the false hopes, the feigned friendship. Ertu had played this one on him countless times, finding him in his moments of despair, lifting him from the emotional valleys, then dropping him even deeper into the pit of black hopelessness.
I have spoken with Morik, the voice went on, but Wulfgar was no longer listening. He claims innocence,
Captain Dudermont stubbornly continued, despite Robillard's huffing doubts at his side.
Yet the dog Sharky has implicated you both.
Trying to ignore the words, Wulfgar let out a low growl, certain that it was Ertu come again to torment him.
Wulfgar?
Dudermont asked. It is useless, Robillard said flatly.
Give me something, my friend,
Dudermont went on, leaning heavily on a cane for support, for his strength had far from returned.
Some word that you are innocent, so that I might tell Magistrate Jarkel to release you.
No response came back, other than the continued growl.
Just tell me the truth, Dudermont prodded. I don't believe that you were involved, but I must hear it from you if I am to demand a proper trial.
He can't answer you, Captain, Robillard said, because there is no truth to tell that will exonerate him.
You heard Morik, Dudermont replied, for the two had just come from Morik's cell, where the little thief had vehemently proclaimed his and Wolfgar's innocence. He explained that Creeps Sharky had offered quite a treasure for Dudermont's head, but that he and Wolfgar had flatly refused.
I heard a desperate man weave a desperate tale, Robillard replied.
We could find a priest to interrogate him, Dudermont said. Many of them have spells to detect such lies.
Not allowed by Luskin law, Robillard replied. Too many priests bring their own agendas to the interrogation.
The magistrate handles his questioning in his own rather successful manner. He tortures them until they admit guilt, whether or not the admission is true, Dudermont supplied.
Robillard shrugged. He gets results.
He fills his carnival.
How many of those in the carnival do you believe to be innocent, Captain? Robillard asked bluntly.
Even those innocent of the particular crime for which they are being punished have no doubt committed many other atrocities.
That is a rather cynical view of justice, my friend, Dudermont said.
That is reality, Robillard answered.
Dudermont sighed and looked back to Wolfgar, hanging and growling, not proclaiming his innocence, not proclaiming anything at all.
Dudermont called to the man again, even moved over and tapped him on the side.
"You must give me a reason to believe Morik," he said. Wolfgar felt the gentle touch of a succubus, luring him into emotional hell. With a roar, he swung his hips and kicked out, just grazing the surprised captain, but clipping him hard enough to send him staggering backward to the floor. Robillard sent a ball of sticky goo from his wand, aiming low to pin Wolfgar's legs against the wall. The big man thrashed wildly, but with his wrists firmly chained and his legs stuck fast to the wall, the movement did little but reinvigorate the agony in his shoulders. Robillard was before him, hissing and sneering, whispering some chant. The wizard reached up, grabbed Wolfgar's groin, and sent a shock of electricity surging into the big man that brought a howl of pain.
No, Dudermont said, struggling to his feet. No more!
Robillard gave a sharp twist and spun away, his face contorted with outrage.
Do you need more proof, Captain? He demanded.
Dudermont wanted to offer a retort, but found none.
Let us leave this place, he said.
Better that we had never come, Robillard muttered.
Wolfgar was alone again, hanging easily until Robillard's wand material dissipated, for the goo supported his weight.
Soon enough, though, he was hanging by just the shackles again, his muscles bunching in renewed pain. He fell away, deeper and darker than ever before. He wanted a bottle to crawl into, needed the burning liquid to release his mind from the torments.
Chapter 12. To Her Family True.
Merchant Banshee to speak with you, Steward Temegast announced as he stepped into the garden.
Lord Feringal and Miralda had been standing quiet, enjoying the smells and the pretty sights, the flowers and the glowing orange sunset over the dark waters.
"Bring him out," the young man replied, happy to show off his newest trophy.
"Better that you come to him," Temegast said. "Banshee is a nervous one, and he's in a rush. He'll not be much company to dear Miralda. I suspect he will ruin the mood of the garden."
"Well, we cannot allow that,"
Lord Feringal conceded. With a smile to Miralda and a pat of her hand, he started toward Temegast. Feringal walked past the steward, and Temegast offered Miralda a wink to let her know he had just saved her from a long tenure of tedium. The young woman was far from insulted at being excluded. Also, the ease with which Feringal had agreed to go along surprised her. Now she was free to enjoy the fabulous gardens alone,
free to touch the flowers and take in their silky texture, to bask in their aromas without the constant pressure of having an adoring man following her every movement with his eyes and hands. She savored the moment, and vowed that after she was lady of the castle, she would spend many such moments out in this garden alone. But she was not alone. She spun around to find Priscilla watching her.
"It is my garden, after all,"
the woman said coldly, moving to water a row of bright blue bachelor buttons.
"So Steward Temegast told me,"
Meralda replied. Priscilla didn't respond, didn't even look up from her watering.
"It surprised me to learn of it,"
Meralda went on, her eyes narrowing.
"It's so beautiful, after all."
That brought Priscilla's eyes up in a flash. The woman was very aware of insults. Scowling mightily, she strode toward Meralda. For a moment, the younger woman thought Priscilla might try to strike her, or douse her, perhaps, with the bucket of water.
"My! Aren't you the pretty one?"
Priscilla remarked.
"And only a pretty one like you could make so beautiful a garden, of course." "Pretty inside,"
Meralda replied, not backing down an inch. She recognized that her posture had indeed caught the imposing Priscilla off guard.
"And yes, I'm knowing enough about flowers to understand that the way you talk to them and the way you're touching them is what makes them grow. Begging your pardon, Lady Priscilla, but you're not for showing me any side of yourself that's favoring to flowers." "Begging my pardon?"
Priscilla echoed. She stood straight, her eyes wide, stunned by the peasant woman's bluntness. She stammered over a couple of replies before Meralda cut her off.
"By my own eyes, it's the most beautiful garden in all of Orkney," she said,
breaking eye contact with Priscilla to take in the view of the flowers, emphasizing her words with a wondrous look of approval.
"I thought you hateful and all."
She turned back to face the woman directly. But Meralda was not scowling. Priscilla's frown, too, had somewhat abated.
"Now I'm knowing better. For anyone who could make a garden so delightful is hiding delights of her own."
She ended with a disarming grin that even Priscilla could not easily dismiss.
"I have been working on this garden for years,"
the older woman explained.
"Planting and tending, finding flowers to come to color every 10 days of every summer."
"And the work's showing,"
Meralda sincerely congratulated her.
"I'll wager there's not a garden to match it in Luskin, or even Waterdeep."
Meralda couldn't suppress a bit of a smile to see Priscilla blushing. She'd found the woman's weak spot.
"It is a pretty garden,"
the woman said.
"But Waterdeep has gardens the size of Castle Auk."
"Bigger, then. But sure to be no more beautiful,"
the unrelenting Meralda remarked. Priscilla stammered again, so obviously off guard from the unexpected flattery from this peasant girl.
"Thank you,"
she managed to blurt out, and her chubby face lit up with as wide a smile as Meralda could ever have imagined.
"Would you like to see something special?"
Meralda was at first wary, for she certainly had a hard time trusting Priscilla, but she decided to take a chance. Priscilla grabbed her by the hand and tugged her back into the castle, through a couple of small rooms, down a hidden stairway, and to a small open-air courtyard that seemed more like a hole in the castle design, an empty space barely wide enough for the two of them to stand side by side. Meralda laughed aloud at the sight, for while the walls were naught but cracked and weathered gray stone, there, in the middle of the courtyard, stood a row of poppies, most the usual deep red, but several a delicate pink variety that Meralda didn't recognize.
"I work with the plants in here,"
Priscilla explained, guiding Meralda to the pots. She knelt before the red poppies first, stroking the stem with one hand while pushing down the petals to reveal the dark core of the flower with the other.
"See how rough the stem is?"
she asked. Meralda nodded as she reached out to touch the solid plant. Priscilla abruptly stood and guided Miralda to the other pots containing lighter-colored poppies. Again she revealed the core of the flower, this time showing it to be white, not dark. When Miralda touched the stem of this plant, she found it to be much more delicate.
"For years I have been using lighter and lighter plants," Priscilla explained, "until I achieved this, a poppy so very different from its original stock."
"Priscilla poppies!" Miralda exclaimed. She was delighted to see surly Priscilla Auk actually break into a laugh.
"But you've earned the name," Miralda went on. "You should be taking them to the merchants when they come in on their trek between Hundlestone and Luskin. Wouldn't the ladies of Luskin pay a high price for so delicate a poppy?"
"The merchants who come to Orkney are interested only in trading for practical things," Priscilla replied. "Tools and weapons, food and drink, always drink, and perhaps a bit of 10-town scrimshaw. Lord Ferry has quite a collection of that."
"I'd love to see it."
Priscilla gave her a rather strange look then.
"You will, I suppose,"
she said somewhat dryly, as if only remembering then that this was no ordinary peasant servant, but the woman who would soon be the Lady of Orkney.
"But you should be selling your flowers,"
Miralda continued encouragingly.
"Take them to Luskin, perhaps. To the open-air markets, I've heard, are so very wonderful."
The smile returned to Priscilla's face, at least a bit.
"Yes, well, we shall see,"
she replied, a haughty undercurrent returning to her tone.
"Of course, only village peasants hawk their wares."
Miralda wasn't too put off. She had made more progress with Priscilla in this one day than she ever expected to make in a lifetime.
"Ah, there you are!"
Steward Temegast stood in the doorway to the castle. As usual, his timing couldn't have been better.
"Pray forgive us, dear Miralda, but Lord Feringle will be caught in a meeting all the night, I fear. For Bansy can be a demon in bartering, and he has actually brought a few pieces that have caught Lord Feringle's eye. He bade me to inquire if you would like to visit tomorrow during the day."
Miralda looked to Priscilla, hoping for some clue, but the woman was tending her flowers again, as if Miralda and Temegast weren't even there.
"Tell him that surely I will,"
Miralda replied.
"I pray that you are not too angry with us," said Temegast.
Miralda laughed at the absurd notion.
"Very well, then. Perhaps you should be right away, for the coach is waiting, and I fear a storm will come up tonight,"
Temegast said as he moved aside.
"Your Priscilla poppies are as beautiful a flower as I've ever seen,"
Miralda said to the woman who would soon be her kin. Priscilla caught her by the pleat of her dress, and when she turned back, startled, she grew even more surprised, for Priscilla held a small pink poppy out to her. The two shared a smile, and Miralda swept past Temegast into the castle proper. The steward hesitated in following, though, turning his attention to Lady Priscilla.
"A friend?"
he asked.
"Hardly,"
came the cold reply.
"Perhaps if she has her own flower, she will leave mine in peace."
Temegast chuckled, drawing an icy stare from Priscilla.
"A friend, a lady friend, might not be so bad a thing as you seem to believe,"
the steward remarked. He turned and hastened to catch up to Miralda, leaving Priscilla kneeling in her private garden with some very curious and unexpected thoughts. Many budding ideas rode with Miralda on the way back to her house from Castle Auk. She had handled Priscilla well, she thought, and even dared to hope that she and the woman might become real friends one day. Even as that notion crossed her mind, it brought a burst of laughter from the young woman's lips. In truth, she couldn't imagine ever having a close friendship with Priscilla, who would always, always consider herself Miralda's superior. But Miralda knew better now, and not because of that day's interaction with the woman, but rather because of the previous night's interaction with Jack Askooly. How much better Miralda understood the world now, or at least her corner of it. She had used the previous night as a turning point.
It had taken that one moment of control, by Miralda and for Miralda, to accept the wider and less appealing responsibility that had been thrown her way. Yes, she would play Lord Feringhal now, bringing him on her heel to the wedding chapel of Castle Auk. She, and more importantly her family, would get from him what they required. While such gains would come at a cost to Miralda, it was a cost that this new woman, no more a girl, would pay willingly and with some measure of control. She was glad she hadn't seen much of Lord Feringhal tonight, though. No doubt he would have tried to force himself on her, and Miralda doubted she could have maintained the self-control necessary to not laugh at him. Smiling, satisfied, the young woman stared out the coach's window as the twisting road rolled by. She saw him, and suddenly her smile disappeared. Jacka Schooley stood atop a rocky bluff, a lone figure staring down at the place where the driver normally let Miralda out. Miralda leaned out the coach window opposite Jacka, so she would not be seen by him.
"Good driver, please take me all the way to my door this night."
"Oh, but I hoped you'd ask me that this particular ride, Miss Miralda,"
Liam Woodgate replied.
"Seems one of my horses is having a bit of a problem with a shoe. Might your father have a straight bar and a hammer?"
"Of course he does," Miralda replied. "Take me to my house, and I'm sure that me dad'll help you fix that shoe."
"Good enough, then,"
the driver replied. He gave the reins a bit of a snap that sent the horses trotting along more swiftly. Miralda fell back in her seat and stared out the window at the silhouette of a slender man she knew to be Jacka from his forlorn posture. In her mind, she could see his expression clearly. She almost reconsidered her course and told the driver to let her out. Maybe she should go to Jacka again and make love under the stars one more time, be free for yet another night. Perhaps she should run away with him and live her life for her sake and no one else's. No, she couldn't do that to her mother, or her father, or Tori. Miralda was a daughter her parents could depend upon to do the right thing. The right thing, Miralda knew, was to put her affections for Jacka Schooley far behind her. The coach pulled up before the Ganderlay house. Liam Woodgate, a nimble fellow, hopped down and pulled open Miralda's door before she could reach for the latch.
"You're not needing to do that,"
the young woman stated as the gnome helped her out of the carriage.
"But you're to be the Lady of Orkney,"
the cheery old fellow replied with a smile and a wink.
"Can't be having you treated like a peasant now, can we?"
"It's not so bad," Miralda replied, adding, "being a peasant, I mean."
Liam laughed heartily.
"Gets you out of the castle at night."
"And gets you back in whenever you're wanting,"
Liam replied.
"Steward Temegast says I'm at your disposal, Miss Miralda. I'm to take you and your family, if you so please, wherever you're wanting to go."
Miralda smiled widely and nodded her thanks. She noticed then that her grim-faced father had opened the door and was standing just within the house.
"Da,"
Miralda called.
"Might you help my friend?"
The woman paused and looked to the driver.
"Why, I'm not even knowing your proper name," she remarked.
"Most noble ladies don't take the time to ask," he replied,
and both he and Miralda laughed again.
"Besides, we all look alike to you big folks."
He winked mischievously, then bowed low.
"Liam Woodgate at your service."
Donny Ganderlay walked over. "A short stay at the castle this night," he remarked suspiciously.
"Lord Feringhal got busy with a merchant," Miralda replied. "I'm to return on the morrow. Liam here's having a bit of trouble with a horseshoe. Might you help him?"
Donny looked past the driver to the team and nodded. "Course," he answered. "Get yourself inside, girl," he instructed Miralda. "Your ma's taken ill again." Miralda bolted for the house. She found her mother in bed, hot with fever again, her eyes sunken deep into her face. Tori was kneeling beside the bed, a mug of water in one hand, a wet towel in the other.
She got the weeps soon after you left,
Tori explained, a nasty affliction that had been plaguing Beasta off and on for several months. Looking at her mother, Miralda wanted to fall down and cry. How frail the woman appeared, how unpredictable her health. It was as if Beasta Ganderlay had been walking a fine line on the edge of her own grave day after day. Good spirits alone had sustained the woman these last days, since Lord Feringal had come calling, Miralda knew. Desperately, the young woman grasped at the only medication she had available. "Oh, Ma," she said, feigning exasperation, "aren't you picking a fine time to fall ill again?"
"Miralda,"
Beasta Ganderlay breathed, and even that seemed a labor to her.
"We'll just have to get you better and be quick about it,"
Miralda said sternly.
"Miralda," Tori complained. "I told you about Lady Priscilla's garden," Miralda went on, ignoring her sister's protest. "Get better and be quick, because tomorrow you're to join me at the castle. We'll walk the garden together."
"And me?"
Tori pleaded. Miralda turned to regard her and noticed that she had another audience member. Donny Ganderlay stood at the door, leaning on the jamb, a surprised expression on his strong but weary face.
"Yeah, Tori, you can join us,"
Miralda said, trying hard to ignore her father.
"But you must promise that you'll behave."
"Oh, Ma, please get better quickly,"
Tori implored Beasta, clutching the woman's hand firmly. It did seem as if the sickly woman showed a little bit more life at that moment.
"Go, Tori," Miralda instructed. "Run to the coach driver, Liam's his name, and tell him that we three will be needing a ride to the castle at midday tomorrow. We can't have Ma walking all the way."
Tori ran off as instructed, and Miralda bent low over her mother.
"Get well,"
she whispered, kissing the woman on the forehead. Beasta smiled and nodded her intent to try. Miralda walked out of the room under the scrutinizing gaze of Donny Ganderlay. She heard the man pull the curtain closed to her parents' room, then follow her to the middle of the common room.
"Will he let you bring them both?"
Donny asked, softly, so that Beasta would not hear. She shrugged.
"I'm to be his wife, and that's his idea. He'd be a fool to not grant me this one favor."
Donny Ganderlay's face melted into a grateful smile as he fell into his daughter, hugging her closely. Though she couldn't see his face, Miralda knew that he was crying. She returned that hug tenfold, burying her face in her father's strong shoulder, a not-so-subtle reminder to her that, though she was being the brave soldier for the good of her family, she was still, in many ways, a scared little girl. How warm it felt to her, a reassurance that she was doing the right thing when her father kissed her on top of her head. Up on the hill a short distance away, Jackis Schooley watched Donny Ganderlay help the coachman fix the horseshoe, the two of them talking and chuckling as if they were old friends. Considering the treatment Donny Ganderlay had given him the previous night, the sight nearly leveled poor, jealous Jacka. Didn't Donny understand that Lord Feringal wanted the same things for which Donny had chastised him? Couldn't the man see that Jacka's intentions were better than Lord Feringal's? That he was more akin to Miralda's class and background, and would therefore be a better choice for her? Donny went back into the house then, and Miralda's sister soon emerged, jumping for joy as she rushed over to speak with the coachman.
"Have I no allies?"
Jacka asked quietly, chewing on his bottom lip petulantly.
"Are they all against me, blinded by the unearned wealth and prestige of Feringal Orc? Damn you, Miralda! How could you betray me so?" he cried, heedless if his wail carried down to Tori and the driver.
He couldn't look at them anymore. Jacka clenched his fists and smacked them hard against his eyes, falling on his back to the hard ground.
"What justice is this life?" he cried. "Oh, fie! To have been born a pauper, aye, when the mantle of a king would better suit! What justice allows that fool Feringal to claim the prize? What universal order so decrees that the purse is stronger than the loins? Oh, fie this life, and damn Miralda!"
Long after Liam Woodgate had repaired the shoe, shared a drink with Tony Ganderlay and departed. Long after Miralda's mother had fallen into a comfortable sleep at last. Long after Miralda had confided to Tori all that had happened with Jacka, Feringle, Priscilla, and Temegast. And long after the storm Temegast had predicted arrived with all its fury, pelting the prone Jacka with drenching rain and buffeting him with cold ocean winds. He lay there, muttering curses and mewling like a trapped cat. He still lay upon the hill when the clouds were swept away, making room for a brilliant sunrise, when the workers made their way to the fields. One worker, the only dwarf among the group, moved over to the young man and nudged him with the toe of one boot.
"You dead or dead drunk?"
the gnarly creature asked. Jacka rolled away from him, stifling the groan that came from the stiffness in his every muscle and joint. Too wounded in pride to respond, too angry to face anyone, the young man scrambled up to his feet and ran off.
"Strange bird, that one,"
the dwarf remarked, and those around him nodded. Much later that morning, when his clothes had dried and with the chill of the night's wind and rain still deep under his skin, Jacka returned to the fields for his workday, suffering the berating of the field boss and the teasing of the other workers. He fought hard to tend to his work properly, but it was a struggle, for his thoughts remained jumbled, his spirit sagged, and his skin felt clammy under the relentless sun. It only got worse for him when he saw Lord Feringle's coach roll by on the road below, first heading toward Miralda's house, then back again, loaded with more than one passenger. They were all against him. Miralda enjoyed that day at Castle Auk more than any of her previous visits, though Lord Feringle did little to hide his disappointment that he would not have Miralda to himself. Priscilla boiled at the thought of three peasants in her wondrous garden. Still, Feringle got over it soon enough, and Priscilla, with some coughing reminders from Steward Temegast, remained outwardly polite. All that mattered to Miralda was to see her mother smiling and holding her frail face up to the sunlight, basking in the warmth and the sweet scents. The scene only strengthened Miralda's resolve and gave her hope for the future. They didn't remain at the castle for long, just an hour in the garden, a light lunch, then another short stroll around the flowers. At Miralda's bidding, an apology of sorts to Lord Feringle for the unexpected additions, the young lord rode in the coach back to the Ganderlay house, leaving a sour Priscilla and Temegast at the castle door. "Peasants," Priscilla muttered. "I should batter that brother of mine about the head for bringing such folk to Castle Auk." Temegast chuckled at the woman's predictability. "They are uncultured indeed," the steward admitted. "Not unpleasant, though." "Mud-eaters," said Priscilla. "Perhaps you view this situation from an errant perspective," Temegast said, turning a wry smile on the woman. "There is but one way to view peasants," Priscilla retorted. "One must look down upon them."
"But the Ganderlays are to be peasants no more," Temegast couldn't resist reminding her.
Priscilla scoffed doubtfully.
"Perhaps you should view this as a challenge," suggested Temegast.
He paused until Priscilla turned a curious eye upon him.
"Like coaxing a delicate flower from a bulb."
"Ganderlay's delicate,"
Priscilla remarked incredulously.
"Perhaps they could be, with the help of Lady Priscilla Auk," said Temegast. "What a grand accomplishment it would be for Priscilla to enlighten them so. A feat that would make her brother brag to every merchant who passed through, an amazing accomplishment that would no doubt reach the ears of Luskin society, a plume in Priscilla's bonnet."
Priscilla snorted again, her expression unconvinced, but she said no more, not even her usual muttered insults. As she walked away, her expression changed to one of thoughtful curiosity, in the midst of some planning, perhaps. Temegast recognized that she had taken his bait, or nibbled it at least. The old steward shook his head. It never ceased to amaze him how most nobles considered themselves so much better than the people they ruled, even though that rule was always no more than an accident of birth. Chapter 13 Prisoner's Carnival. It was an hour of beatings and taunting, of eager peasants throwing rotten food and spitting in their faces. It was an hour that Wolfgar didn't even register. The man was so far removed from the spectacle of Prisoner's Carnival, so well hidden within a private emotional place, a place created through the mental discipline that had allowed him to survive the torments of Ertu, that he didn't even see the twisted, perverted faces of the peasants, or hear the magistrate's assistant stirring up the mob for the real show when Jarkeld joined them on the huge stage. The barbarian was bound, as were the other three, with his hands behind his back and secured to a strong wooden post. Weights were chained around his ankles and another one around his neck, heavy enough to bow the head of powerful Wolfgar. He had recognized the crowd with crystalline clarity. The drooling peasants, screaming for blood and torture. The excited, almost elated ogre guards working the crowd, and the unfortunate prisoners. He'd seen them for what they were, and his mind had transformed them into something else, something demonic. The twisted, leering faces of Ertu's minions, slobbering over him with their acidic drool, nipping at him with their sharpened fangs and horrid breath. He smelled the fog of Ertu's home again, the sulfuric abyss burning his nostrils and his throat, adding an extra sting to all of his many, many wounds. He felt the itching of the centipedes and spiders crawling over and inside his skin, always on the edge of death, always wishing for it. As those torments had continued, day after 10 day after month, Wolfgar had found his escape in a tiny corner of his consciousness. Locked inside, he was oblivious to his surroundings. Here at the carnival, he went to that place. One by one, the prisoners were taken from the posts and paraded around, sometimes close enough to be abused by the peasants, other times led to instruments of torture. Those included cross ties for whipping, a block and tackle designed to hoist victims into the air by a pole lashed under their arms locked behind their back, and ankle stocks to hang prisoners upside down in buckets of filthy water, or, in the case of unfortunate Creeps Sharky, a bucket of urine. Creeps cried through most of it, while Tianiknik and Wolfgar stoically accepted whatever punishment the magistrate's assistant could dish out without a sound other than the occasional unavoidable gasp of air being blasted from their lungs. Morik took it all in stride, protesting his innocence and throwing witty comments around, which only got him beaten all the worse. Magistrate Jarkeld appeared, entering to howls and cheers, wearing a thick black robe and cap and carrying a silver scroll tube. He moved to the center of the stage, standing between the prisoners to eye them deliberately one by one. Jarkeld stepped out front. With a dramatic flourish, he presented the scroll tube, the damning documents, bringing eager shouts and cheers, each movement distinct, with an appropriate response mounting to a crescendo. Jarkeld popped the cap from the tube's end and removed the documents. Unrolling them, the magistrate showed the documents to the crowd one at a time, reading each prisoner's name. The magistrate surely seemed akin to Ertu, the carnival barker ordering the torments. Even his voice sounded to the barbarian like that of the Baelor, grating, guttural, inhuman.
"I shall tell to you a tale," Jarkeld began, "of treachery and deceit, of friendship abused and murder attempted for profit. That man," he said powerfully, pointing to Creep Sharky, "that man told it to me in full, and the sheer horror of it has stolen my sleep every night since."
The magistrate went on to detail the crime as Sharky had presented it. All of it had been Morik's idea, according to the wretch. Morik and Wolfgar had lured Deutermont into the open so that Tianiknik could sting him with a poison dart. Morik was supposed to sting the honorable captain, too, using a different variety of poison, to ensure that the priests could not save the man,
but the city guard had arrived too quickly for that second assault. Throughout the planning, Creeps Sharky had tried to talk them out of it, but he'd said nothing to anyone else out of fear of Wolfgar. The big man had threatened to tear his head from his shoulders and kick it down every street in Luskin. Enough of those gathered in the crowd had fallen victim to Wolfgar's enforcer tactics of the Cutlass to find that last part credible.
"You four are charged with conspiracy and intent to heinously murder good man Captain Dudermont, a visitor in excellent standing to our fair city," Jarkeld said when he completed the story and let the howls and jeers from the crowd die away. "You four are charged with the infliction of serious harm to the same. In the interest of justice and fairness, we will hear your answers to these charges."
He walked over to Creeps Sharky.
"Did I relate the tale as you told it to me?" he asked.
"You did, sir, you did,"
Creeps Sharky eagerly replied.
"They done it, all of it."
Many in the crowd yelled out their doubts about that, while others merely laughed at the man, so pitiful did he sound.
"Mr. Sharky," Jarkeld went on, "do you admit your guilt to the first charge?" "Innocent," Sharky protested, sounding confident that his cooperation had allowed him to escape the worst of the carnival.
But the jeers of the crowd all but drowned out his voice.
"Do you admit your guilt to the second charge against you?"
"Innocent,"
the man said defiantly, and he gave a gap-toothed smile to the magistrate.
"Guilty," cried an old woman. "Guilty he is, and deserving to die horrible for trying to blame the others."
100 cries arose, agreeing with the woman, but Creech Sharky held fast his smile and apparent confidence. Jarkeld walked out to the front of the platform and patted his hands in the air, trying to calm the crowd. When at last they quieted, he said,
"The tale of Creep Sharky has allowed us to convict the others. Thus we have promised leniency to the man for his cooperation."
That brought a rumble of boos and derisive whistles.
"For his honesty, and for the fact that he, by his own words, undisputed by the others, was not directly involved."
"I'll dispute it," Morik cried, and the crowd howled. Jarkeld merely motioned to one of the guards, and Morik got the butt of a club slammed into his belly. More boos erupted throughout the crowd, but Jarkeld denied the calls, and a smile widened on the face of clever Creep Sharky.
"We promised him leniency,"
Jarkeld said, throwing up his hands as if there was nothing he could do about it.
"Thus, we shall kill him quickly."
That stole the smile from the face of Creeps Sharky and turned the chorus of boos into roars of agreement. Sputtering protests, his legs failing him, Creeps Sharky was dragged to a block and forced to kneel before it.
"Innocent I am," he cried, but his protest ended abruptly as one of the guards forced him over the block, slamming his face against the wood.
A huge executioner holding a monstrous axe stepped up to the block.
"The blow won't fall clean if you struggle,"
a guard advised him. Creeps Sharky lifted his head.
"But ye promised me."
The guard slammed him back down on the block.
"Quit your wiggling,"
one of them ordered. The terrified Creeps jerked free and fell to the platform, rolling desperately. There was pandemonium as the guards grabbed at him. He kicked wildly, the crowd howled and laughed, and cries of, "Hang him! Keel haul!" and other horrible suggestions for execution echoed from every corner of the square. "Lovely gathering," Captain Dudermont said sarcastically to Robillard. They stood with several other members of Sea Sprite among the leaping and shouting folk. "Justice," the wizard stated firmly.
"I wonder," the captain said pensively, "is it justice or entertainment? There is a fine line, my friend, and considering this almost daily spectacle, it's one I believe the authorities in Luskin long ago crossed."
"You were the one who wanted to come here," Robillard reminded him.
"It is my duty to be here and witness," Dudermont answered.
"I meant here in Luskin," Robillard clarified. "You wanted to come to this city, Captain. I preferred Waterdeep."
Dudemont fixed his wizard friend with a stern glare, but he had no rebuttal to offer.
"Stop your wiggling!"
the guard yelled at Creeps, but the dirty man fought all the harder, kicking and squealing desperately. He managed to evade their grasps for some time, to the delight of the onlookers, who were thoroughly enjoying the spectacle. Creeps's frantic movements brought his gaze in line with Jarkeld. The magistrate fixed him with a glare so intense and punishing that Creeps stopped moving.
"Draw and quarter him,"
Jarkeld said slowly and deliberately. The gathering reached a new level of joyous howling. Creeps had witnessed that ultimate form of execution only twice in his years, and that was enough to steal the blood from his face, to send him into a fit of trembling, to make him, right there in front of 1,000 onlookers, wet himself.
"He promised,"
he mouthed, barely able to draw breath, but loud enough for the magistrate to hear and come over to him.
"I did promise leniency," Jarkeld said quietly. "And so I will honor my word to you, but only if you cooperate. The choice is yours to make."
Those in the crowd close enough to hear groaned their protests, but Jarkeld ignored them.
"I have 4 horses in waiting,"
Jarkeld warned. Creeps started crying.
"Take him to the block,"
the magistrate instructed the guards. This time Creeps made no move against them, offered no resistance at all as they dragged him back, forced him into a kneeling position, and pushed his head down.
"He promised,"
Creeps softly cried his last words, but the cold magistrate only smiled and nodded. Not to Creeps, but to the large man standing beside him. The huge axe swept down, the crowd gasped as one, then broke into howls. The head of Creep's Sharky tumbled to the platform and rolled a short distance. One of the guards rushed to it and held it up, turning it to face the headless body. Legend had it that with a perfect swift cut and a quick guard, the beheaded man might still be conscious for a split second, long enough to see his own body, his face contorted into an expression of the purest, most exquisite horror. Not this time, though. For Creeps Sharky wore the same sad expression.
"Beautiful," Morik muttered sarcastically at the other end of the platform.
"Yet it's a better fate by far than the rest of us will find this day." Flanking him on either side, neither Wolfgar nor Tianiknik offered a reply.
"Just beautiful," the doomed rogue said again.
Morik was not unaccustomed to finding himself in rather desperate situations, but this was the first time he ever felt himself totally without options. He shot Tianiknik a look of utter contempt, then turned his attention to Wolfgar. The big man seemed so impassive and distanced from the mayhem around them that Morik envied him his oblivion. The rogue heard Jarkeld's continuing banter as he worked up the crowd. He apologized for the rather unentertaining execution of Creeps Sharky, explaining the occasional need for such mercy, else why would anyone ever confess? Morik drowned out the magistrate's blather and willed his mind to a place where he was safe and happy. He thought of Wolfgar, of how against all odds they had become friends. Once they had been rivals, the new barbarian rising in reputation on Half Moon Street, particularly after he had killed the brute Tree Block Breaker. The only remaining operator with a reputation to protect, Morik had considered eliminating Wolfgar, though murder had never really been the rogue's preferred method. Then there had come the strangest of encounters. A dark elf, a damned drow, had come to Morik in his rented room, had just walked in without warning, and had bade Morik to keep a close watch over Wolfgar, but not to hurt the man. The dark elf had paid Morik well. Realizing that gold coins were better payment than the sharpened edge of drow weapons, the rogue had gone along with the plan, watching Wolfgar more and more closely as the days slipped past. They'd even become drinking partners, spending late nights, often until dawn, together at the docks. Morik had never heard from that dark elf again. If the order had come from him to eliminate Wolfgar, he doubted he would have accepted the contract.
He realized now that if he heard the dark elves were coming to kill the barbarian, Morik would have stood by Wolfgar. Well, the rogue admitted more realistically, he might not have stood beside Wolfgar, but he would have warned the barbarian, then run far, far away. Now there was nowhere to run. Morik wondered briefly again if those dark elves would show up to save this human in whom they had taken such an interest. Perhaps a legion of drow warriors would storm prisoners' carnival, their fine blades slicing apart the macabre onlookers as they worked their way to the platform. The fantasy could not hold, for Morik knew they would not be coming for Wolfgar, not this time. "I am truly sorry, my friend," he apologized to Wolfgar, for Morik could not dismiss